Hello, everyone. Welcome to Nothing But Now, Mindful Living with me, Dr. Mary Angela McGuire, on Transformation Talk Radio. During this show, I'll help you practice mindfulness. Most of the principles of mindfulness are very simple, but putting those principles into practice can be devilishly difficult. I'm here to help you become a student of your own mind. I'll share ideas, insights, and tools you can use to release yourself from fearful and negative thinking and live from a place of clarity and confidence. Please join me as we challenge ourselves to change. Nothing But Now starts now. I'm Mary Angela McGuire, and you're listening to Nothing But Now on Transformation Talk Radio. Thank you for joining me today. You know, the purpose of this show is to support people on their mindfulness journey, on a journey towards greater mindfulness. And mindfulness is bringing our attention to the present moment without judgment. And one of the things I've been talking about lately is the relationship between our habits of mind, habits of mindlessness, in fact, and racism. For whites specifically, how is it that a belief in white racial superiority has become deeply embedded in our consciousness? And how can we bring that belief to conscious awareness in order to change it? If we want to unearth and change a deeply held belief, one thing we have to notice is how we feed our minds. What information do we consume? One barrier for whites is having very limited and therefore distorted information about and experience with Black Americans. As part of my own mindfulness journey, I want to use this platform to disrupt the habits of mind that reinforce beliefs about white racial superiority. Disrupting those habits means feeding my mind and yours with counter-narratives, stories from Black Americans about their ordinary yet extraordinary lives, starting now. My guest today is Mr. Virgil Jones. Virgil and I met many years ago when we both worked at a small college in central Minnesota. Virgil, welcome to Nothing But Now, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you being the first one to do this and have this conversation with me. It's great of you to do that. You know, Virgil, we've talked about this conversation, and I know that we're going to talk about, and you're going to tell us about your response to George Floyd's murder. We're going to talk about equity in K-12 education because you are a K-12 educator. We're going to talk about your personal journey and the legacy of your late father, Virgil Jones, who was a Chicago alderman. I really appreciate you bringing these topics to our conversation. And as I mentioned before, we start each show with breathing. Will you join me in that?
Absolutely.
Thank you. So we bring conscious attention to our breath so that we can feel calm, so that we can focus our mind and enhance our clarity. So remember, after the inhale, make the pause briefly, then make the exhalation longer than the inhalation. And this is Lori Cameron, who is a mindfulness educator. This is her practice called three deep breaths. So the first breath, we're just going to pay attention to the physical sensation of the air entering and exiting our body. For the second breath, we're going to notice any place in our body where we feel tension and relax. And then for the third breath, we're going to set our intention. What do we need right now? So here we go. Breath number one, just pay attention to our breath. Breath two, relax. And breath three, set our intention. Thanks for doing that with me. So my guest today is Virgil Jones. Virgil, would you start by telling us a little bit about your family, your work, and sort of set the context for our conversation?
Well, I think it's important to, I guess, start with my parents. I'm the son of Virgil and Mary Jones. My mother was originally from the big city of Vicksburg, Mississippi, which was a huge battleground location for the Civil War. Right. And my father was from the Henry Horner Housing Projects of the west side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And both of them and their families have really played a foundational piece in most of who I am. And I've had some great relationships through where I attended college, mm-hmm. where I went to high school, and ultimately some professional things that have provided me with the opportunity to try to leave the world a little bit better than the way I found it.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Virgil, are you married? You have kids? You want to tell us a little bit about family and about your work?
Yeah, so whenever somebody asks me who I am, I'd rather tell them the question really comes to me more like who you be, right? And I'm a father of four beautiful kids. My oldest is a young woman who'll be starting high school. And then I have her name's Samara. And then I have a son, Elijah, which Elijah and Samara are not necessarily atypical names, but they both have meanings. And all of my kids, their names have some significance other than just giving them a name. And then I have identical twin boys. I call them my miracle babies. They were born at 2.5 pounds, about 10 weeks early, and are as smart and kind and resilient as you would ever want in two little boys. So,
And how old are they now?
and then my wife, they're 10
Yes.
years old, and then my wife grew up in a big town. I call it a big town. She graduated with like 40 people in a southern Minnesota town. Oddly enough, we went to college together, but we did not know each other at
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
I knew her. I knew some of her roommates, but I didn't know her.
Okay. And that was at UW La Crosse?
Yes, we like to refer to it as the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse.
Now, wait a minute, Virgil. I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, so you be careful about
Football
that.
programs are pretty similar.
So, Virgil, you are the athletic director and the vice principal at Apple Valley High School in Apple Valley, Minnesota. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And how long have you been there?
So I've been in the district now. I'm finishing my fourth year as athletic director and starting my fifth year. And then I was at Rosemount High School prior to that for a couple of years as I was working on my principal's license. Both were invaluable experiences going to a school district that I went from, obviously, Gustavus Adolphus College, which was about 2,500 students, to go into a school district that had 30,000 students in it in its entirety.
Yeah, that's
Was kind of
amazing.
an interesting experience. The high school, Rosemount, where I worked right after I left Gustavus to go to District 196, almost had as many students in the high school as we did at the college. So.
That's amazing. That's a big transition. So Apple Valley is about how far from downtown Minneapolis?
It's about probably 40 minutes, 35 to 40 minutes. It's actually probably most known for its wrestling and basketball programs. The speech program is phenomenal there as well. But our high-profile athletes have been pretty well known across the state of Minnesota and nationally. But we're 20 minutes south of the Mall of America, if that gives people a little bit more of a geographical idea of where we're located. But next year, at the end of this NBA draft, we will have three players in the NBA.
Oh my gosh.
This year had athletics not taking the turn that it did due to COVID-19. Even with that happening, I guess, we still had six Division I All-Americans from one high school this year.
Wow.
So
So
it's a pretty special place.
And especially to be then the athletic director. My goodness, what a job.
It comes with a great deal of responsibility
Yes, and
and
expectation.
expectations and probably a little bit of stress too, so.
Yeah, exactly. So Virgil, you are not at the epicenter. You don't live in central Minneapolis, but you're not very far. And of course, the shockwaves from George Floyd's murder have been enormous, gone all around the world. Would you talk to us a little bit about this was one of the topics that you wanted to talk about today. And where are you at with it? How what's the impact been? Can you tell us about your perspective on it?
Well, yeah, and I would say I live in a community that's about 45 minutes outside of the city, but I have relationships with lots of my former students who are doing nonprofit work, who live in the communities that have been greatest affected by this, who are on the front lines of the protests that are happening in the Twin Cities, who are supporting kids and families through the process of navigating what I consider one of the most unprecedented times in my life, anyways, as it relates to race relations. And while I don't live in the city, I currently live in a predominantly white community, and as a black man with biracial children, those things that are happening in the city still weigh heavily on your mind, no matter where you're at. So, I actually did not see the video of the George Floyd murder until the following evening. I had heard about it, and I'd gotten some invitations from folks who had invited me to come with them to protest. And I was trying to get more information about what was actually happening. And then when I heard what was happening, I actually hesitated for a little bit because I didn't really want to watch it. It took some convincing from another African American friend of mine who said to me, I told him, I said, here's what I know. And he said, if you watch the video, it's gonna hurt your soul. And I was like, I don't want to watch it. He goes, you have to watch it. You have to see what's happening in our world right now. And, I think I would have gotten around to doing it. But I think with social media and the world that we live in today, if you're involved in the struggle at all for equity, for rights that we all should have as citizens of the United States, some of those things can be really traumatic, especially if you get to watch them over and over and over again. And our emotional response to those things sometimes doesn't necessarily always have a harness. And so
What do you mean?
when I think about that, I was a little resistant to watching it. And what it caused me to do is it bothered me to the degree that I'm a closet poet. I write for therapy.
You have
And
just told the world, so good job. Now you're not in the closet about that anymore.
well, I shared with, I was up, I couldn't sleep, and so I was up the following day at about 4 in the morning, and all I could do was write. And so I wrote a poem that I'd like to share with you.
Oh, what? Thank you.
The poem's called Gasping for Air. Four cops on just one. He was dead as soon as it begun. The people in the streets pleading for you to stop his nose from bleeding. But instead, you took his last breath. Inhale and exhale as I apply pressure on you. We saw him put his hand near his pocket until you turned blue. You weren't human to him. He no longer feels the rhythm of your heart as helpless bystanders film two worlds growing oceans apart. George lays in handcuffs, his face pressed into the ground, with no sense of agency left. It wasn't enough, so you took his air, his last breath. A grown man scared enough to cry out, Mama! He held him down with no fear of any drama. We watched his life leave his body and ascend away. Onlookers can't forget the fear in his face from that day. George closing his eyes and looking at death. It wasn't enough. So you took his air, his last breath. Four cops on just one. He was dead before it begun. The people in the streets pleading for you to stop his nose from bleeding, but instead you took his last breath. That to
Thank
me
you.
was kind of what I was feeling at the time. And I think of that in the context that I'm a relative. My father was directly related to Emmett Till. And so for
Oh.
my family, this kind of violence of white men against black men is part of my family history. It's
Right.
something, when I was first questioning race, it was the story of Emmett Till was the story my dad told me.
Oh my.
And I think you think about how many years have passed and we're still seeming to be in the same, what I call the Groundhog Day for black people kind of moment when it comes to police brutality. And at the end of the day, I heard Philando Castile's mother say something the other day that I thought was extremely profound. She said, when are we going to stop looking away from American citizens being killed violently? And I think I often get asked by lots of people when they talk about, well, why can't we all just be Americans? And I remind them that they have to define for me what that means. Because I know that I'm a US citizen. I know what my passport gives me in terms of my rights to enter and exit the country. And if I was in another country, what the consulate could do for me.
Right.
But as an American, I know that there's two Americas because I've went to school in two Americas. I've been to predominantly white schools. I've worked in predominantly white institutions. And I know that they're not the same.
Right. Right.
So I'm alarmed. I'm scared for my boys.
Right.
In particular, I'm scared for my daughter.
Sure.
Because I know that these things exist. When you and I worked together, shortly after you went on to your next institution, and I was supporting a conference that was an anti-racist conference, I had white supremacist organizations threatening me. But it doesn't, it never for once made me reconsider the fight.
Right.
I'm from a family that is really an abolitionist family. And what I mean by that, and a lot of people get that kind of a little twisted when they think about what an abolitionist is, and they think of it as somebody who wanted to abolish slavery.
Okay.
In my family, an abolitionist is somebody who's willing to give their life to abolish slavery. And there's a difference.
Right. Absolutely. Wow, that's a powerful point. That's a really powerful point.
So I think at the end of the day, as an educator, somebody who's a father, who has, I have wonderful friends of all races. It's disheartening to watch such anger and hate happening in our country. And I was struck by a question my 12-year-old asked me. He asked me, were there really people who would try to harm him physically because of the color of his skin? And I had to really pause and think about what my response was going to be to him because it could shape his whole viewpoint on people who didn't look like
him. Right.
And the thing that I thought was most helpful to him was to explain to him what my responsibility was to him as his father, as my father was to my father, and my grandfather was, my grandfather was to my father and his father and so on. I can't always be everywhere with my kids.
Right.
My job as a black father is to teach them to be able to identify those hateful people as quickly as possible. And then to figure out an exit strategy. And that may be an exit strategy that requires being more cunning than anything else. Or it may require them to do what they need to do by any means necessary.
Right.
But those are things that I have to have conversations with my son about, because a lot of my white colleagues and neighbors, they're fortunate to be able to have the talk, you know, the talk, right? And that talk is about the birds and bees. It's about giving. It's about giving life.
Right.
Right.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
My talk is about how to save your life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's the paradox in our country right now.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that is the hardest thing, the place where the white imagination fails most quickly is the inability to see the two levels of consciousness you always have to maintain as a Black man, as a Black person in America. I think I don't know if it's because, I don't think it's because we're white, we don't have the imagination. I just think it's very hard to understand and to imagine that level of almost kind of personal surveillance of noticing your environment at that level. You know, I think whites often, a complaint is Black people shouldn't talk about race so much. Mm. And one of the things I've been saying is, I'll bet they don't really want to, but what choice do they have?
Right? Absolutely.
Do you have a choice not to talk about race? Do you have a choice not to have that conversation with your child?
Well, and do you not have the choice to think of it as part of the reason why you're having certain kinds of experiences, right?
Right, right.
I think, you know, that's one of the things that you have to rule out first before you can get to more basic kinds of reasons why your interactions are a certain kind of way.
Can you illustrate that for me?
So, I tell this story once about, I was working for this educational consulting company.
Okay.
And I worked with curriculum instruction directors and academic department leads in different school districts for this company. And I remember calling and making a appointment with this particular director once. Mm-hmm. And I set the appointment, showed up at his office a week later, right, for my meeting. I'm greeted by his assistant, and he had his door open to his office, and he was on the phone.
Okay.
And she told me to sit and wait. And I did that, and I heard him hang up the phone and end his phone conversation. And then I heard him ask his assistant to send me in. Mm-hmm. And when I walked into the office, the look on his face was one of, it's like when you order a steak and somebody brings you roast beef, right?
Okay.
And his response to me, I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "You sounded different over the phone."
Okay.
And I immediately understood what he was thinking. But I also wanted to push him a little bit. And so I wanted to know how I sounded. But that situation, had not had it before.
Right.
I would have been trying to say, okay, well, why is he saying that? Is it because of the color of my skin? Is it because I was articulate?
That classic word.
Right. Whatever that's supposed to mean, right?
Right.
I'm an educated Black man who's got multiple degrees. I should be able to put together a sentence that you can understand, right? And he was like, "Oh," he's like, "Yeah, you just sounded different on the phone." And I was like, "Well, how? Was my voice deeper?" And he was like, "Oh no."
Uh-huh.
I was like, "Am I using bigger words now?"
Right.
And he kind of switched the subject.
I'll bet he did.
But it's one of those things where I think if I was a white person, I'm not sure that comment would have been made. And I'm not sure even if he was thinking in his head, he wouldn't have said it out loud. Mm-hmm. And I had to really think about, okay, is he doing this because I'm Black?
Right.
Is he doing this because I speak well? Mm-hmm. Is he doing this because his secretary didn't give him a heads up?
Right.
Before I came in, Or is he doing this because he didn't do his homework and know who his representative was from this particular company before he met them?
Right. And to me, that his conception of what does a black man look and sound and act like and what kind of job does he have versus this person that showed up in front of him, I mean, to me, that is a very deeply embedded belief in white racial superiority such that he was surprised. I mean, and I don't know how you could interpret that from your position as anything else but a response to your race. And what does that say about not, whether we, I don't need to condemn him to say, what is going on in his mind? What has he fed his mind with over the course of his life that he was surprised and that he couldn't even mask it? I mean, that's, not a good actor. Yeah, just right.
And I left there thinking, here's a person who is responsible for the education of
Oh, right.
children.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for saying that. Right.
And so when we think about how we are in this perpetual 400-year cycle of basically reinventing racism, right? It makes you look at, okay, well, who's leading? Where are these kids learning these things? Where are they getting their cues from? It's from
Who's
us. It's from
shaping?
adults.
That's right. Who's shaping what they feed their minds with? Right.
Absolutely.
And I just, if you don't mind, I want to make one other point about that example is, which is, I think, again, a kind of defensive white perspective could be, what's the big deal? Right? He didn't call you a name. He didn't discriminate in an open way against you. He didn't, I don't know, maybe not take your business or whatever it was. He met with you. And what I always try to remind myself is that was one moment in one day in your life.
Right. And it was supposed to be a professional,
And
not an
so,
informal moment, right?
right. And that you walked into it, you weren't thinking about your blackness walking in the door, right? You were going
Well,
to a business meeting. I mean, and it may be, I don't know, maybe it's always kind of an underlying thought, but I don't think you were leading with that. You were there for a business meeting.
right. But I
But
take my blackness everywhere I go.
yes, as I take my whiteness everywhere I go. But it wasn't like you were there to talk about that.
No.
Or that, and I think because I think that's the an argument that's made to trivialize the Black American experience, which is, oh, you have a chip on your shoulder, like you're expecting trouble. And that's all I mean by it is you didn't walk in there with an expectation that he was going to react to your race. You just walked in there for a business meeting and you saw the reaction. It came to you. It didn't. You didn't go looking for it. And that's the thing that I think is hard as a white person to understand is. You have that thrust upon you, and you never know when it's going to come up. And that's sort of the story or the message you gave to your son. Be ready. Be
Yeah.
prepared. Right.
And I think, when we get back to the basics of race relations, I think, and I've had many conversations with friends of mine about this. One of the greatest swindles in American history has been elite people creating an environment that convinces poor middle class white people that they have more in common with the elite white people than they do with their own neighbors.
And I think that is very succinctly and brilliantly put. Virgil, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about education. We'd like to hear more about your particular journey and your father's legacy. So, folks, you are listening to Nothing But Now on Transformation Talk Radio, and we'll be right back.
Tune in to Lucid Planet Radio with Dr. Kelly Neff. This hit show will illuminate your senses and empower you beyond your daily stressors and hardships. Renowned psychologist and author Dr. Kelly will captivate you with far-reaching topics and amazing guests as you wake to the greatest version of yourself. Learn to tap into your intuitions, think critically about our world, heal emotional and psychological wounds, and follow your passions to live your dreams. The Lucid Planet. Welcome home. Visit lucidplanetradio.com for more information.
For stimulating conversation and keys that will change your life, tune in to Dynamic Destiny with Coach Pete every first and third Wednesday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Join Pete to get clarity for your calling and practical wisdom for results. For more about Coach Pete, visit PeteCoaching.com. That's P-E-T-E coaching.com.
Stuck in a roundabout of dysfunction? Learn how to speak your truth to power with host Dr. Kathy Ober. Create real change with smart tools and smart strategies. No frills, no fluff, just life-changing conversations to help get you where you want to be. Extend your reach and become an agent for real change with Kathy Ober. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyober.com. That's drkathyober.com.
Break your snooze button habits for good with the Soul Stretching Sisters on the I Am Power Hour with me, Terry J. Walker.
And me, Dr. Pat, on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Pump up your spiritual muscle as we share stories.
Aspire higher.
And live a whole lot larger.
To help you unleash your powered up,
pumped up, I Am Soul Stretching Success.
Anything can happen when we take to the airwaves.
And all things become possible during the I Am Power Hour.
Living a richly abundant life sound too good to be true? Listen in to Richly Abundant Women with Julie Steelman on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Embrace a vibrant future of breaking free financially and creating a richly abundant life filled with prosperity and growth. To learn more about Julie Steelman and Richly Abundant Women, visit www.juliesteelman.com.
How do you feel? Just okay? Well, how about you tune in and get ready to be more with The Healing Hour with me, Doc Martin, every third Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. I'm ready for your questions, and I can't wait to help you find the answers. Every month, we'll have a new live call-in show with innovative topics and a powerful hour of healing. To learn more about me, visit DrSharonMartin.com. See you there. I'm going to be here. You won't want to miss it.
Stuck in a roundabout of dysfunction? Learn how to speak your truth to power with host Dr. Kathy Ober. Create real change with smart tools and smart strategies. No frills, no fluff, just life-changing conversations to help get you where you want to be. Extend your reach and become an agent for real change with Kathy Ober. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyober.com. That's drkathyober.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Mary Angela McGuire, and you're listening to Nothing But Now on Transformation Talk Radio. And my guest today is Virgil Jones. Virgil is a vice principal and director of athletics at Apple Valley High School, which I lived in Minnesota for a number of years. I knew many students who'd gone to Apple Valley, but I really did not know the legacy of incredible sports success that you've had there. So we've been talking with Virgil about race in America, but we're going to turn our attention more specifically, given your work as an educator. Will you talk to us a little bit about your views about equity in K-12 education in particular?
Well, I think it's been an interesting journey for me. Obviously, I started my work with ACT, the College Testing Company, in education. Okay. And that provided me with the opportunity to see schools, both large and small, diverse, not diverse, mm-hmm. poor, wealthy, private, public.
Right.
And then my work in at the college level really helped inform just my ideas about where we're at, but also where we should be when it comes to providing a high quality education to every student in America without stealing their dignity.
Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because I think we all might intellectually agree to the first part, but I think that's a powerful thing to say without stealing their dignity.
Well, I mean, I've seen it obviously, I've worked in environments. When I first started working with you, we were really trying to do some unique things around increasing the number of racially underrepresented students at that particular college, which had a low percentage at that time. And over the time that we were able to work there together, we tripled that number. Graduated students at the same rate as its white students, and really gave a opportunity for students who were first generation college students to really be able to show the world what they were capable of.
Absolutely.
But that came with lessons, and it came with me really trying to understand what was the price of a good education. What did those students have to give in that setting in order to achieve? And some of it was, I talk about survivor's guilt a little bit.
Okay.
Is having success academically in a different environment than the one that you came from, and then going out and getting a job and feeling like you left your community behind in some ways if you didn't return to that community in your work.
Right.
And trying to do things to better yourself while not losing your sense of identity and where you came from.
Is that something you... Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, have you experienced that in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have in the sense that my parents, my dad had post-secondary experiences. My mom did not, right? He came from the city of Chicago where there were more opportunities, I felt like, for African-American black folks at that time than there would have been in Vicksburg, Mississippi at that time.
Right.
And I think the gender dynamic was also played a huge role in that. So that intersectionality for the two of them put them both on different paths in terms of their lives. And so I think for me, you know, I'm able to provide guidance to my kids that maybe my parents weren't able to provide me along the educational pathways, understanding internships, not asking questions about what do you want to be when you grow up, right? Instead asking questions to my children about what problems do you want to solve?
Oh, that's a nice framing, yeah.
Because there's multiple occupations that you could be in that could solve the same problem, right?
Right.
And not necessarily being so tunnel vision about this one thing that maybe you decide that you don't love science enough to be able to use it to be a physician, for instance. And maybe you want to be a research scientist or you want to do something else with it. I think that survivor's guilt is more about understanding how you're contributing to pulling others up with you as you ascend. So I never really get too caught up in the ego of, you know, being the first person to do this, being the first person to do that, in the sense that I want to be the person who maybe was the first person to help somebody else who didn't think they had a chance to be able to be in the position that I'm in, be able to do that. Because those are the things that lessen that sense of guilt about achievement.
Right. Okay. So in your experience in K-12 education now, are you hopeful? Are you concerned that things are not really better?
I work in a phenomenal school environment with phenomenal staff and great kids. And I'm very hopeful about what happens in my building.
Okay.
I do see a lot of, in talking to colleagues and other people in other school districts, I think that there's this perception out there that somehow in 2020, we're less segregated than we were 40 years ago.
Right.
And I think that that's a fallacy.
Right.
And I think if people really wanted to see, they'd pay closer attention. Mm-hmm. Because the segregation is both racially still happening on a large scale, mm-hmm. and it's also happening economically on a large right. scale. Mm-hmm. And I'm a African-American person, right? So I understand the dynamics of what race does in a educational system. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting a full dissertation in what class does in an economic system.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, as educators, that's one of the things, you know, working in a predominantly white higher ed institution and mm-hmm. seeing the struggles of lower income kids of all races, right, in that type of environment. But then going into a public school system, you think about, okay, well, these kids at the college level are just going to have to grind through this for 4 years. Right. Then when you get into K-12, you realize they've been grinding through that for a decade already.
Right. Exactly. And
I think it's important for us as educators not to lose sight of that and to continue to do what we can to create equity in those situations for our kids. And that includes hiring. I would love to be in a situation where I could help institutions think more broadly about who's educating kids on a day-to-day basis. How do they get to see themselves in their classroom? Right. How do they get to see their future selves in the mm-hmm. teachers mm-hmm. and other staff that they engage with?
Right, right. Are you one of the few African-Americans in the leadership position at your school, or are...
There are currently two of us in my type role. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I work in an environment that's 50% of the kids are non-white.
Right.
And we might have 5% of the teachers that are non-white.
Right.
And that's not to say you can't have white allies, right?
Oh, right, right.
Because a lot of where I am today is because of white allies, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Harriet Tubman's success on the Underground Railroad was because of white allies.
Right. Right. Right.
You have to have both.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
In order to go faster, I guess is
yes. Well, that's a great way to put it. Yeah. In order to go faster. Yeah.
And so, you know, but this is not just about, you know, my school. I mean, I've seen it for the last two decades. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot more work to do. We can't rest on our laurels that we hire one person here, one person there.
Right.
You and I have a colleague friend who, you know, he's the only African-American tenured professor in the history of the institution he's worked for almost 40 years.
Right.
We've got to do better than that.
We've got to do better than that. And I think the most, you know, to me, the critical thing that you mentioned was not asking students to sacrifice their dignity. And I think that does come up certainly around racial lines, but class also. And when I was at that institution, I always joked that every student said they were middle class, whether they were poor or rich. They all were trying to, you know, fit themselves into a box so that they didn't stand out along those lines. But they weren't, and their dignity was at risk. And I think you're right, it's worse in K-12. It's a long journey through K-12 if you're poor.
Absolutely.
Very long journey. So preparing you for your journey, will you talk to us a little bit about your dad, your mom, your mother? Can you just tell me, because she was from Vicksburg, when did she come up north?
She had a brother and a sister who were living in Chicago.
Okay.
And she moved there with them to find work.
Mm-hmm.
I think she had a 10th grade education and at the time was working on her GED.
Okay.
And my aunt and uncle, I believe, had they used to have a weekly, I like to call it the WUSA card game on Friday nights after everybody finished their, you know, 50-hour work week during
right.
the week.
Right, right.
And I believe that's how my parents met, was at one of the...
At the card game. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it was more of a card game, music and just people being able to relax and blow off steam from the work week. Mm-hmm. But my dad grew up in Chicago in the Henry Horner housing projects, was a high school all academic student athlete, mm-hmm. Went on to go to college at Eureka College for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But he was always very involved in the plight of Black people in his community. Mm-hmm. And Eureka College is in Eureka, Illinois.
Yep.
And I think my father found out very quickly that he may be too Black to be at Eureka College.
He sounded different on the phone, huh?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. He was there and he played and started there for a couple of years, but I think his heart was in trying to uplift people in his community. Right. So he came back to Chicago and worked at a Boys and Girls Club that was located just outside of one of the buildings in Chicago, and ultimately did some social work, mm-hmm. Led him into when he had me, he needed to earn more money, and he became a Chicago police officer.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And did that for about 15, 16 years, and then got into the world of politics.
Okay.
And for my dad, I think Chicago politics can be very cutthroat.
Yes.
And dangerous.
Yeah.
And I remember when he first got elected, he said to me that if I do this right, mm-hmm. eventually they will try to assassinate my character.
And did they?
Ultimately. Mm-hmm. And I think his civic service was extremely important to him. Mm-hmm. And his ability to do what he could to provide opportunities for people in the Black community who elected him to represent them was near and dear to his heart. And I think when he passed away almost 2 years ago, mm-hmm. I think that although it was a treacherous road to be a politician in the city of Chicago representing the Black community, I don't think he would have changed much of it except for the outcome.
Mm-hmm. And what was that legacy for you then? And what do you take into your day-to-day life, into your thoughts about the future from his legacy?
Well, I think he used to always tell me that you got two things that are guaranteed in life. Is that you're Black and that you're going to die one day.
Okay.
Everything else is... Mm-hmm. about how people will remember you, mm-hmm. and how you made them feel.
Right.
And there's lots of ways, you know, I used to talk about, well, maybe I should go into politics. And he would say, no, you don't want to do that. He said, there's other ways that you can impact the lives of people other than getting churned out in the machine. Mm-hmm. And you know, I now have a better understanding about what he means about meant about that because of the roles that I've had and the role I'm currently in. But it definitely stuck with me that I think I said at the beginning of this, like my whole goal in life is to obviously provide a safe passage for my kids through this life, mm-hmm. And help them realize their potential. Mm-hmm. But it's also to leave other people who I engage with feeling good about their interaction with me, and also leaving whatever situations, whatever projects, whatever organizations we're working in a better situation than the way that we found them. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's legacy, that's progress, and that's minimizing ego and giving to other people, and really thinking about like servant leadership as really being that mm-hmm. foundational component for me.
Mm-hmm. What does servant leadership mean to you? That's not necessarily a familiar term to everyone.
Servant leadership to me is being in the service of others okay. while leading with character with authenticity mm-hmm. and with good intentions. So that's what it means to me. And it's why I think I'm in education now. And I think it's why I left corporate America, is because I didn't necessarily feel that I was able to be that type of person in that, in that environment.
Are there challenges to it, though, even in the job you have and the work you do now?
Oh, yeah. I think athletic directors, I'll just talk about that one particular part of my job, themselves are, I believe, some of the most unsung heroes in the education system. And I say that because I don't believe that there's anyone in education who puts in, other than a principal maybe, more time with kids and parents in a building. I believe that you see people at their peaks of joy and the bottom of their despair. And whether that is about winning and losing, whether that is about having success or not success, growth, not growth, injuries, family dynamics, racism. I mean, you get to engage with the whole thing if you choose to, I had a conversation with some colleagues the other day that we were talking about the George Floyd thing, and I was really proud of this group of athletic directors that I work with in the South Suburban Conference, because I think that they all recognize that we can do more.
Oh. Were there things in particular that you all are talking about?
Well, I mean, we're in the business of kids, right? And so one of the things we talked about is, if we return to school in a normal environment with the trial of these police officers coming up,
with
the election coming up, how are we going to be prepared to lead? How are we going to prepare our coaches to lead in a way that helps us move forward with these discussions, with people feeling as if they're included in that conversation and they know how to handle situations to gain understanding.
I think that's incredible that, you know, I think most listeners, I don't know that we'd all be thinking about what role will athletic directors be playing in this situation, but, you know, you've described it so well that you have to, you're dealing with the whole person. And so it will come up. Virgil, we are really close to the end of our time. So I want to know, is there something in particular you'd like to leave the audience with today, a message?
Well, I do. I would say I have a quote that I'd like to read.
Sure.
It's by Audre Lorde.
Okay.
I don't know if many people are familiar with her.
I am. Yes. A wonderful poet. Yeah.
And this is really the message I leave people with who are out there fighting the fight right now, trying to leave a better space for our kids in the world than the one we inherited.
Okay.
She wrote, "Sometimes we are blessed with being able to choose the time and the arena and the manner of our revolution. But more usually, we must do battle where we are standing." And I think for me, that kind of sums up where I'm at right now in my life. It sums up what educators do every single day.
Yes.
I think about educators who turned on a dime and took their classroom home with them and went to battle right where they were at, right?
Yes.
They didn't get to choose, right? They didn't get to say goodbye to their kids. So I think about that in that context, and I think about that in our awakening right now when it comes to having an equitable America.
Thank you, Virgil. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so grateful to you. Folks, I hope you'll join me next week on Nothing But Now on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks, Virgil. Have a great day.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Nothing But Now, Mindful Living with Dr. Mary Angela McGuire on Transformation Talk Radio. Join me next time as we continue to practice mindfulness and challenge ourselves to change. If you'd like to find out more about my work or contact me, please go to my website, McGuireLifeCoach.com. That's McGuireLifeCoach.com. See you next time.
The music for Nothing But Now was created by Salt Theory.